Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated August 3rd. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's lead article, Top of the Fold, Ongoing Learning Rules for Doctors Eased, by Jason DeBrune, from Raleigh. Beginning this month, professional training requirements for doctors are being slashed under a direction by state regulators. While the change could be perceived as arming doctors with less knowledge of medicine, especially if it means they don't keep up with the latest medical technologies and procedures, representatives of the North Carolina Medical Board and North Carolina Medical Society say they think the change will actually have the opposite result. In many respects, the changes actually make the continuing education of higher quality and more meaningful, says Dr. Scott Kirby, a practicing physician and medical director for the North Carolina Medical Board, a state agency that regulates the practice of medicine and surgery. I don't think physicians will play more golf simply on the basis of the change in CME, known as Continuing Medical Education Rules. Dr. Harry Gallus, the North Carolina Medical Society CME staff consultant, agrees with Kirby. I don't think it's something that should concern the citizens of North Carolina, he says, largely because of expanded recertification processes that doctors must go through every 5 to 10 years, depending on the specialty. CME is a component of recertification, but there are other requirements that look more closely at the practice itself and what physicians do to improve the medical care in that practice. That's more valuable to overall health care than research on areas outside the individual physician's field, Gallus says. The recertification process has not always been as stringent as it is now, and Gallus even predicts it could be more so in the future. Before the medical board cut out the Category 2 requirements, North Carolina ranked among the states that required the most CME, according to data compiled by the American Medical Association. Arizona and Arkansas, for example, require only 20 hours per year, and South Dakota requires none. Some states still require more Category 1 CME than North Carolina. Three states, Michigan, Minnesota, and New Mexico, require 75 hours of Category 1 CME, where North Carolina requires only 60 per 3 years. While the medical board is a regulatory body, the medical society is a physicians group that represents the interest of physicians. To maintain a license from the medical board, physicians were required to document 150 hours of continuing medical education, or CME, every 3 years. The board reduced that number to 60 hours effectively August 1st. A more nuanced look at the numbers, however, tells the story that the board did more than simply chop the CME requirements by nearly two-thirds. CME breaks down into two categories. The first is for accredited education, such as classes or conferences or other events that are put on by medical agencies and can be more easily defined. Physicians are required to document 60 hours of this type of CME every 3 years, and that will remain unchanged going forward. The second category counts more nebulous education, such as reading an academic journal article, having a doctor-to-doctor consultation, or doing various activities with educational value that is more difficult to define. In the past, doctors were required to log 90 hours every 3 years of this kind of CME, but this requirement has now been completely eliminated. Kirby says the sheer drop in the number of hours was one reason the board had been reticent to make these changes. It did appear that the board was backing off substantially of continuing education, he says. In fact, it's not, and the board feels it is very important to maintain education. Regardless of making it a documented requirement, nearly all physicians perform the Category 2 CME anyway, says Kirby and others. Requiring the actual documentation simply gets in the way and becomes one more administrative burden on doctors. Next up, Who is Utility Chair Finley? By Chris Bagley. From Raleigh. The man probing deep into Duke Energy Corporation's boardroom built a career as a lawyer representing utilities before taking a pay cut to become one of the most powerful people in state government. As chairman of the North Carolina Utilities Commission, Ed Finley, age 63, has primary responsibility for setting the commission's agenda, including its ongoing investigation of Duke's directors' 10-5 vote to push out CEO Bill Johnston just 2 hours after he joined the company in its merger with Raleigh-based Progress Energy. Attorneys who practiced before the commission described Finley as having been the unofficial dean of the Public Utilities Bar before Governor Mike Easley appointed him to the commission in February 2007. All describe him as direct and deliberate, as cutting right to the key issue with carefully chosen words, a style he displayed in 3 days of questioning executives and directors last month. One attorney pointed to Finley's response to a lawyer representing Duke who asked to cross-examine Johnston on July 19th. Quote, "You don't have that right, and we're not going to hear you on that, so sit down, please," end quote, Finley told the attorney. Fewer than 24 attorneys regularly represent utilities clients before the commission. In that close-knit world, none of the half-dozen contacted for this article would speak on the record about Finley, whose commission holds significant power over their clients. Still, all profess admiration for him and describe him as fair and impartial. Most know Finley both from his years in private practice and as a commissioner. Several other people who work with him were mostly in agreement. Quote, "He is, in my view, a real straight shooter, a no-nonsense guy. Relatively soft speaker, but not afraid to speak out when he has to," end quote, says Greg White, a utilities commissioner in Michigan who serves with Finley on the board of a quasi-government group that oversees power transmission among 13 eastern states. "He's considerate and he's deliberate. He takes information in and asks good questions." Finley is scheduled to take over from White as president of the group in October. Through spokesman John Romano, Governor Beverly Perdue calls Finley impartial, knowledgeable, and a problem solver. Perdue reappointed Finley to an 8-year term in July 2011. He had strong support from many different sides, including the consumer community and the legal community, Romano says. Finley and one of his 5 fellow commissioners declined to be interviewed, noting the sensitivity of the Duke investigation. Finley has noted that the commission has the legal authority to rescind its approval of the merger, which few observers expect, or retroactively attach conditions. Finley himself has suggested that a settlement also is a possibility. Attorneys who have worked with Finley note he took a significant pay cut to join the commission. His state salary is $139,000 annually, a modest fracture of what senior attorneys earn in private practice. Finley himself practiced in the Raleigh office of Hunton and Williams, whose other notable alumni include Johnston, the ousted Duke CEO. Hunton and Williams represented Progress in merger negotiations with Duke. While at Hunton, Finley mostly represented water, sewer, and telecommunications companies. Environmental activist Jim Warren says Finley's background on the industry side is a potential cause for concern, particularly in a state that now hosts the nation's largest utility company, Duke Energy. "There have been frustrations among public interest groups. There have been concerns," says Warren, who leads the North Carolina Waste Awareness and Reduction Network in Durham, and is a frequent critic of utilities. "Any regulator in that situation has to work extra hard to remain impartial." Next up, Yarber was sketching out own bank. By Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. Former Capital Bank CEO Grant Yarber was sketching out plans for a regional banking operation of his own, even identifying possible acquisition targets around the time he suddenly departed Capital back in November 2011. An email Yarber sent to potential investors to drum up support for his ambitious plans has become part of the court record in Yarber's lawsuit against Charlotte-based Capital Bank Financial Corporation, or CBFC, the private equity group that bought Capital Bank. In the suit, Yarber, now a Durham Furniture executive, says he was terminated when CBFC head Gene Taylor learned of his, Yarber's, plans for a new bank. According to the 7-page investor email, Yarber wanted to buy Mountain First Bank of Hendersonville and then, using that as a platform, begin looking to make other buys. Among the potential targets were Johnston County-based Four Oaks Bank, Apex-based Patriot State Bank, Trust Atlantic Bank in Raleigh, Yadkinville-based Yadkin Valley Bank, Southern Community Bank in Winston-Salem, and First South Bank in Washington. I know the CEO of Four Oaks very well, and he and my wife are tennis doubles partners, Yarber wrote investors. He and his investment bankers are anxious to begin conversations. Yarber, who was Capital's CEO from 2003 to 2011, brought the lawsuit in U.S. District Court claiming that he still owed $1.1 million change of control payment stemming from the CBFC takeover. CBFC counters that claim and has asked that the suit be dismissed. In his email, Yarber reveals the extent to which he had examined the possibility of rolling several banks into a single company. He wrote to potential investors, quote, Southern Community Bank, Trust Atlantic Bank, Yadkin Valley Bank, and Patriot State executives and I have known each other for at least 7 years, end quote. At another point in the email, Yarber even allows that while still CEO of Capital Bank, a position he gave up after the CBFC takeover, he had attempted to buy Washington, North Carolina-based First South Bank. Quote, due diligence was done and the price agreed, but due to director issues, the deal did not go through, end quote, Yarber wrote. Asked for a comment, Yarber, now the president and CEO of Durham-based Amazon Millworks, an importer of hardwood doors, paneling, and other architectural woodwork, says he can't discuss any of the aspects related to the suit. As for his one-time banking plan, he added that no concrete steps were ever taken to forward it. Attempts to reach Yarber's attorney, Stuart Fisher of Durham, for comment were not successful. CBFC, formerly known as North American Financial Holdings, subsequently purchased Southern Community, one of the banks on Yarber's list, in a deal that is expected to close by the third quarter, says CBFC's Susie Winchell. Continuing on the inside, owners would reap millions in sale of CarQuest, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Raleigh. If the parent company of CarQuest Auto Parts is successful in finding a buyer for its retail store chain, the deal, estimated at as much as $2 billion, would create a windfall for the company's owners. The problem is, few people know who those owners are. O. Temple Sloan, Jr., the founder of General Parts International and its chairman, is presumed to be the majority owner, perhaps the sole owner. His son, O. Temple Sloan III, is president and CEO and may have been bequeathed an ownership stake, but the tight-lipped company has nothing to say on the point. The Raleigh company is a secretive player in high-stakes retail sector dotted with familiar names like Advanced Auto Parts, AutoZone, and O'Reilly Automotive. But those companies are publicly traded. General Parts is private and clear on that point. We are a private company, and we can't comment on any rumors you may have heard. General Parts spokeswoman Dorothy Brown Smith, speaking on behalf of Sloan Jr., said when asked about reports that the retail stores are for sale, we find it's a big distraction for team members. Sloan III did not return calls for comment. A crack in the company's private dealings may have opened in July when published reports sent ripples through the auto parts retail industry that stated General Parts wants to auction off its retail store holdings. The company owns about 1,400 of CarQuest's more than 3,000 stores in North America. The CarQuest stores owned by other operators or individuals would not be included in an auction. General Parts reportedly has hired Wells Fargo to assist with the sale process and has garnered interest from several big private equity firms. Among the firms identified as having interest in CarQuest are Leonard Green & Partners of Los Angeles and KKR & Company of New York. Leonard Green has ownership in retailers that include the BJ's Wholesale Club, Whole Foods Market, and Rite Aid. KKR has ownership in companies including U.S. Foods, Toys R Us, and GoDaddy.com. But it's been obvious for the last few years that General Parts has been working to trim the fat from its balance sheet. In 2006, General Parts employed about 24,500 people. In 2011, General Parts' employee base had dropped to 14,000 people. In that same time frame, General Parts' revenue has grown by nearly 20% from $2.4 billion in 2006 to $2.87 billion in 2011. The company in late 2010 sold most of its company-owned real estate to a New York real estate investment trust for $258 million and then signed long-term leases to continue occupying all of the buildings. The portfolio included 29 distribution warehouses in the United States and Canada, as well as the company's office buildings at its headquarters campus on Millbrook Road in Raleigh. Proceeds from the property sale were used to retire the employee stock purchase plan and corporate debt. For a private equity player, General Parts offers a leaner company coupled with an auto parts retail industry that has been growing revenues and profits as Americans have been spending more at auto repair shops and do-it-yourself parts stores to keep their cars in working order instead of buying new cars. Morningstar analyst Liang Fang says CarQuest is one of the only major players in a mostly fragmented commercial market sector that targets auto mechanics and repair shops rather than individual consumers who buy larger quantities of product but also demand discounted prices. A private equity firm might be able to expand their market more, Fang says, but most auto parts retailers already receive very high margins in relation to other retail products, but it's hard to have all the right parts at the right time. And now, GE revs up, Durham operation growing and adding jobs. By Chris Bagley, from Durham. Demand for new fuel-efficient aircraft, such as the Boeing 787 Dreamliner, is translating into billions of dollars in engines being built by GE Aviation, leading the company to expand a production line at its factory off Miami Boulevard and create as many as 100 manufacturing jobs paying around $60,000 apiece. The company has hired about 90 technicians since early 2011 as it begins to ramp up production of the Gen X turbofan engine, bringing headcount in Durham to around 320. The plant put out 120 of the engines in 2011, is on track to complete 160 in 2012, and is likely to produce about 300 engines in 2014 as the expanded Gen X line goes into full production, plant manager Mike Wagner says. That expansion and increased activity on other engine lines are likely to require still more workers in the next year or so, Wagner says. I wouldn't be surprised if we grew by 50, Wagner says. The company says it's taken more than $17 billion in orders in recent weeks. Manufacturers typically fill such orders over periods of 10 years or more. GE Aviation's plants in Durham and near its headquarters in Evendale, Ohio, perform final assembly, while most components are fabricated by GE Aviation and outside vendors at other locations. GE Aviation is an operating subsidiary of Fairfield, Connecticut-based General Electric Company. Technicians at the Durham plant earn $25 to $35 an hour, Wagner says, or $50,000 to $70,000 annually based on a 40-hour week. Groups of 15 to 20 technicians meet every afternoon at 2:30 p.m. between shifts to plan collaboratively for the next 24 hours. Wagner's official title is site leader, and he says his role is less that of a manager and more of a coordinator. Along with the Gen X, a new line of relatively large engines, many of the orders are for the Leap, a line of smaller engines that the company is developing in partnership with Snema SA, a French company for narrow-body and regional airliners. A July 25 deal with Boeing and Aeromexico involves 180 LEAP engines and a total list price of $2.25 billion for 90 Boeing 737s, for example. The Gen X is one of several new energy-efficient lines from the industry, whose other major players are United Technology Corporation's Pratt & Whitney unit and Rolls-Royce PLC. Boeing estimates that the 787, which seats 210 to 290 passengers in various configurations, is about 20% more fuel efficient than the Boeing 767, which is slightly smaller. Boeing and GE say the engines account for nearly half of the efficiency gain, with much of the remainder coming from use of lighter composite materials. Each aircraft has two engines, which account for about 10% of its $200 million list price. Airlines' huge wave of investment in new aircraft and engines is a direct response to fuel prices' dramatic rise in the last decade, says Bob Herbst, CEO of Airline Financials. Fuel accounts for 25% to 30% of airlines' expenses nowadays, up from 10% to 11% just 10 years ago, Herbst estimates. The Dreamliner is a particularly effective tool for managing those costs, he says. It's just so economical compared to other aircraft, Herbst says. Boeing and independent analysis have also pointed to the 787 as an ideal aircraft to fly point-to-point to overseas destinations, bypassing hubs. They point to its 7,500-mile range and its size larger than the popular 737, but smaller than many other wide-body airlines. Boeing says customers have chosen Gen X engines for 61% of 589 Dreamliners on order, with Rolls engines accounting for the remaining 39%. Customers haven't yet given an engine choice for another 270 Dreamliners on order. Aircraft manufacturers frequently offer two or more engine choices. Aviation is a high-margin segment for GE. It accounted for just 13% of GE's $147 billion revenue in 2011, but a whopping 25% of the company's $14.1 billion profit. Morningstar analyst Neil Dihora says engines' initial sale price are just one portion of the engine's manufacturer total revenue and product and profit. He says periodic overhauls are also an important piece of the puzzle, and like source work at the Durham factory, and likely a source of work at the Durham factory for perhaps 20 years. Next up, due to size, CQ coming under new federal office. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. The North Carolina State Employees Credit Union, or CQ, the nation's second largest, will come under greater scrutiny from a new regulatory office being formed by the federal agency that insures credit union deposits. The National Credit Union Administration, or NCUA, says its new Office of National Examinations and Supervision will oversee credit unions with assets of $10 billion or more, thereby focusing on where most of the industry's risk is concentrated. That's a select group of at least four organizations out of the 7,019 credit unions now operating in the United States. The four are Navy Federal Credit Union with assets of $47 billion, CQ at $24 billion, Pentagon Federal, $15 billion, and Boeing Employees, $10 billion. Navy Federal and Pentagon, both based in Virginia, are federally chartered. CQ and Boeing are state chartered. NCUA spokesman John Fairbanks says the examinations office is expected to open its doors early next year and actually take over supervision of the mega credit unions in 2014. CQ President Jim Blaine, who says he is only starting to find out how the new office will operate, believes the move is part and parcel of the trend in financial reform to regulate institutions by size. Quote, "I think they want to get a better grip on the degree of risk out there," end quote, says Blaine. He also sees no connection between the proposal and the recent dust-up between CQ and NCUA over Blaine's decision to release CQ's confidential CAMEL regulatory score as an act of transparency. NCUA stood in strenuous opposition to that move. "I've been fussing with them, NCUA, over some things," says Blaine, "but I'm not fussing about this," the new examinations office. As a state-chartered credit union, CQ's primary regulator is the North Carolina Credit Union Division. Division Administrator Jerry Jay says she, too, is waiting to see the outlines of the new federal examinations office. At the same time, she adds, it will not change her mission. "Our role will not be diminished," she says. "I am still there, CQ's regulator, and NCUA is the deposit insurer." Navy Federal and Pentagon, both based in Virginia, are federally chartered. CQ and Boeing are state chartered. NCUA spokesman John Fairbanks says the examinations office is expected to open its doors early next year and actually take over supervision of the mega credit unions in 2014. CQ President Jim Blaine, who says he is only starting to find out how the new office will operate, believes the move is just part and parcel of the trend in financial reform to regulate institutions by size. "I think they want to get a better grip on the degree of risk out there," says Blaine. He also sees no connection between the proposal and the recent dust-up between CQ and NCUA over Blaine's decision to release CQ's confidential CAMEL regulatory score as an act of transparency. NCUA stood in strenuous opposition to that move. "Oh, I've been fussing with them, NCUA, over some things," says Blaine, "but I'm not fussing about this," the new examination office. As a state-chartered credit union, CQ's primary regulator is the North Carolina Credit Union Division. Division Administrator Jerry Jay says she, too, is waiting to see the outlines of the new federal examinations office. At the same time, she adds, it will not change her mission. "Our role will not be diminished," she says. "I am still there, CQ's regulator, and NCUA is the deposit insurer's regulator." Next up, North Carolina and Triangle Firms in the mix for a $68 million Terminal 1 renovation. Once the work is complete in early 2014, visitors will be greeted by natural light and a modern look. By Chris Bagley from Morrisville. A $68 million terminal renovation at Raleigh-Durham International Airport will provide work for about 60 North Carolina companies in areas ranging from wiring to tile manufacturing to staircase fabrication. The list of subcontractors range from All Floor Designs, LLC in Raleigh, to Whitman Masonry in Benson. Raleigh area firms are heavily represented, along with a smaller number of companies in the Piedmont Triad and coastal communities. The effort is being coordinated by general contractors Balfour Beatty PLC, a British construction and engineering concern that operates worldwide, and D.H. Griffin, a demolition and environmental services company with headquarters in Greensboro and offices in 8 states. The companies began work on the renovation of Terminal 1 in mid-July. Airport spokeswoman Mindy Hamblin says it's expected to wrap up in early 2014. RDU Deputy Airport Director Dave Powell, who oversees facilities development, says the bulk of the work will be done in 2013, with the work merely ramping up in 2012 and then tailing off in the first 3 or 4 months of 2014. Among the first orders of business will be to expand the building a bit with a baggage handling area, Powell says. Southwest and AirTran, which Southwest acquired in May 2011, now operate out of the terminal's northern extension and are expected to move into the newly renovated space. The extension is not being renovated and may be demolished once the two airlines are gone, Powell says. The concrete apron surrounding the terminal where airliners taxi and park is also being slated for a resurfacing. Balfour Beatty and D.H. Griffin have already chosen the subcontractors, 70 including out-of-state companies. The associated hiring and work will follow in stages over the next 2 years, Hamlin says. The renovation of the terminal has been in the works for years, but plans began to move forward more quickly after the final phase of work was completed on reconstruction of Terminal 2 in October 2008. That terminal's new design lets in ample light from skylights and high windows. The remodeled Terminal 1 will have a similar feel, designed by Pierce Brinkley Cease and Lee of Raleigh. Terminal 1 grew out of several buildings, the oldest of which went up in 1955. The main section, the one now being renovated, opened its current form in 1982. Airport and airline consultant Bob Mann says airports typically go 20 to 30 years between renovations, and Terminal 1 falls within that time frame. And now, quietly, under new CEO, Charles and Covard stages a comeback. By Chris Bagley, from Morrisville. New sales channels have put gemstone producer Charles and Covard Limited on a hot streak, with growing revenue and headcount forcing it to consider an expansion from its suite of offices off Airport Boulevard. The company is also on track for a third consecutive annual profit. That must have seemed unimaginable in early 2010 when CNC reported its third straight annual loss. The company's market value grew to $73 million in late July 2012 from about $11 million in November 2009, before the company hired industry veteran Randy McCullough as CEO. Charles and Covard's bread and butter is sales of finished but loose moissanite gems, which closely resemble diamonds, to jewelry producers. But the company has already begun making and selling finished jewelry, and those sales are growing swiftly. They accounted for about 25% of CNC's $16 million in revenue in 2011 and about 29% of its $9.2 million in revenue in the first half of 2012, according to regulatory filings. The company contracts out most of the jewelry work to overseas jewelry producers in relatively low-cost countries such as China, Vietnam, India, and Mexico. The model allows CNC to take a substantial portion of the added value. An in-house jeweler handles some of the custom orders. The company aims to hire two additional jewelers, among others, to meet growing demand. Headcount has already grown to 43 from 26 in March 2010, forcing the company to reconfigure several sections of its office. Driving that growth are new sales channels. The company in late 2010 began to sell through television shopping networks such as Jewelry Television. It recently launched a new website, moissanite.com, for selling finished jewelry directly to consumers. Most are women buying jewelry for themselves, McCullough says. Every woman wants to wear a 2-carat gem in each ear, but if they wear it in diamond, it's going to cost $20,000 to $30,000, he says. Moissanite.com offers 2-carat moissanite earrings for as little as $779. Of course, those are not diamonds, but they are clear, crystalline, and sparkling. Both are rare in nature, and while both can be fabricated, the process is significantly cheaper with moissanite. Diamond is a pure lattice of carbon atoms formed under extreme heat and pressure, making it among the very hardest substances known to humans. Moissanite is a similar lattice of both carbon and silicon atoms in equal proportion formed under similar heat and pressure, and nearly as hard. Cree Incorporated, a Durham company that makes sophisticated lighting products, holds patents related to synthetic moissanite and supplies Charles and Covard with the raw material. The gem company was founded by Eric Hunter, who co-founded Cree, and his brother, Jeff Hunter. Rob Bates, a senior editor at jewelry trade magazine JCK, notes that Charles & Covart's revenue is still less than half of what it was in the mid-2000s. The fall had a lot to do with an over-reliance on a single retailer, JCPenney, Bates says. And while the jewels image has suffered from unfavorable comparisons to diamonds, marketing efforts by McCullough have helped to change that, Bates adds. You want to sell it on its own merits, Bates says. If you say this is a beautiful stone, it's hard to argue with that. Bates and CNC Vice President Bob Curry also point to improved production processes. Raw Moissanite has a very faint greenish cast and refracts light to sparkle in many different colors, characteristics that makes it less desirable for some customers. But the company recently began sending some of the gems to Serenity Technologies Incorporated in Tacoma, California for whitening. Curry says under the new brand Forever Brilliant, the clearer stones have accounted for some of the increased sales. Next up, with tricky name 3CISD, hauls in grants for growth, by Jason DeBruin, from Cary. A local research and development company has won 6 grants totaling nearly $4.5 million, enabling it to add 19 workers this year and leading its executive director to consider buying land and building a 20,000-square-foot facility. She's even thinking about testing the waters for outside investors. 3C Institute for Social Development in Cary was founded and is led by Melissa DeRozier, a UNC Chapel Hill graduate with a PhD in clinical psychology. Although it's incorporated as a private for-profit company, 3CISD has traditionally lived largely off grants and contracts, mostly from Small Business Innovation Research, or SBIR, contracts. Because of the type of work, most of the contracts come from the U.S. Department of Education. Under such contracts, small businesses receive funding from the government with very few strings attached, says Edward Metz, SBIR program manager for the Institute of Education Sciences, which is the research arm of the Department of Education. The federal government funds the research associated with a product, but it's up to the companies to commercialize that product, he says. The intellectual property stays with the company. The grants are important, but 3CISD's reliance on them as a company, the C's stand for communication, cooperation, and confidence, sells more of its interventions and training programs to educational systems, community agencies, and private practices. DeRozier sees the revenue uptick through its 3C Technologies division more than anywhere, a segment that grew by 20% last year to $600,000 and will grow by another 40% this year, putting it to at least $850,000. In addition, DeRozier says 3C has contracts with more than $1.75 million lined up for the coming years. 3C shows the most success in combining research with training. The company's researchers, DeRozier included, for years have developed social interventions, which are programs to help children and adolescents who fall behind in school, show behavioral or social problems, or don't have the proper family support network. What DeRozier has discovered, however, was that even the best interventions were not hitting their full potential if they weren't implemented properly. So, for the past few years, 3C has worked to develop training models for school psychologists and others to help them apply the interventions better. In addition, 3C's technology is developing programs to help researchers collect and translate data better. Surprisingly, although there are good platforms for collecting data from clinical trials on new pharmaceuticals, there doesn't exist good platforms to do that for social and behavioral research, or to train researchers in these fields, says Dr. David Kupfer, a physician and psychiatrist and a past chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. That's a scary thing, he says. Bradley Stein, a senior scientist with the Santa Monica-based California-based RAND Corporation, who has worked with 3C on intervention development, says he has seen that demand for training firsthand. After publishing an intervention in the Journal of American Medical Association, He had a lot of interest in implementing it. Well, that's wonderful, except that we are not a training company, and we didn't have the workforce to provide the training, he said. Working with 3C helped develop a training model that in the past year has had 1,700 people sign up. Training programs range in price, with some as low as a few hundred dollars. Each set is intended for only one person, however, so a school system would be asked to purchase individual training packages for each member in the system taking the training. Next up, it's Glasses Yes, but NCSU spinoff touts Step Forward with Work. For phones, computers, PC, and the like, better advanced screen technologies are sought after. By Lauren K. Alsons, from Raleigh. The rainbow-tinged piece of glass, just a couple of microns thick, is more than a conversation piece. It's the future, say executives of an 8-year-old North Carolina State University spinoff. The 3-person company is working on developing nearly a dozen applications for their glass technology as they near what they hope will be commercialization deals. Think about a company that makes computer screens in the U.S. Imagine Optics, CEO Aaron Clark says. We're probably working with them in some way. Early in July, Imagine Optics secured a $1 million corporate contract for 6 months of collaborative research. The company is currently raising about $500,000 to supplement the contract, and $3.2 million has been raised from previously from 40 individuals, angel investors. And the company recently agreed to an exploratory partnership with San Diego-based mobile device powerhouse Qualcomm. The glass film being researched by Imagine Optics has applications in everything from mobile screens to lasers. A layer of crystal polymer, similar to the liquid in television screens, only solid, is one of the keys to the technology utilized currently in mobile phone projector prototypes. Projectors use polarized light, and in order to utilize the much more efficient LED lights, the light has to be formatted. That's where Imagine Optics films come in. The company's technology is able to use about 90% of the unpolarized light, instead of the 50% waste seen in current polarizing filters. The low energy usage makes the projectors ideal for cell phones, something that's already happening outside the U.S. through non-Imagine Optics technology. Similarly, the energy saved by using Imagine Optics films in mobile screens could be the difference between a phone battery lasting a day and lasting a month, and could be incorporated into future Qualcomm technology, he adds. Laurent Thirrell, the vice president and general manager of AT&T's mobility and consumer markets in the Carolinas, says the phone efficiency is something companies are always trying to improve upon, and adds that the screen and graphics currently suck up the majority of a phone's battery. We're constantly working with both the hardware players and the operational players to make sure it's the best experience for customers, he says. Battery life absolutely factors into that. But he says it's just one component. Clark equates it to an arms race and says efficiency can be what puts future phones ahead. It's something Taiwanese phone maker HTC is always thinking about, spokesperson Elena Caldwell said, adding the HTC One series introduced 50% to 100% improved battery performance over previous HTC phones. Representatives of Imagine Optics' biggest partner and one of the only ones the company will identify, Japanese screen giant ColorLink Japan, are in town to talk about upping their partnership where screen technology is concerned. And the Department of Defense is researching ways to use the technology so that tablets can be lit up in the field without alerting a foe. We're really trying to avoid adding staff, Clark says, but he admits that contract workers utilized on occasion might not be enough to keep up with the demand forever. But for now, I think we're sustainable. The company's founders, including Clark, technology inventor and tenured professor Michael Iscuti, and NCSU technical director Jason Kikas, still retain about 50% of the equity in the company. Clark says, currently Imagine Optics has 10 corporate partners. Representatives of Qualcomm, a wireless chip manufacturer that employs about 465 in Raleigh, had no comment for this story. Next up, U.S. Supreme Court, healthcare and you. As reform law takes shape, captive plans seen to gain. By Jason DeBrun, from Chapel Hill. With the national health care reform law looking like it's here to stay, a kind of hybrid insurance model is gaining popularity, and employers, especially those with 50 to 200 employees, should take note. The model is called a captive, and it's basically a way for medium-sized companies to join forces and self-insure. It's not a silver bullet, but those in health benefits consulting say it could serve as a model by which employers could save on premiums and take control of their own health plans. Many people think of the health insurance simply as a fully insured model through a company such as Chapel Hill-based Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. However, large companies have found savings in a self-insured model in which the company collects premiums and pays out claims, not the insurer. Here, the benefits are obvious. The company has more control over premium pricing and is not subject to a pool in which an employee from a different company has a major health episode driving up the premiums for all in the pool. Also, any collected premiums in excess of medical bills paid stay as profit for the company. Of course, the model carries higher risk. If the aforementioned health crisis happens to an employee of a self-insured company, all the medical bills fall back on that company. Often, that risk is simply too much for a small or even medium-sized company to bear, so the employer will seek health insurance through a company like United Healthcare, based in Minnetonka, Minnesota, which assumes the risk but also sets the premiums. In the captive model, which, by the way, isn't new but is gaining popularity, like-minded companies can come together to form a captive, which then self-insure all the members of that captive. There are various levels of reinsurance, sometimes called stop-loss or backstop insurance, that the captive can buy to protect against very large claims. Captives are not a new model. They've just reappeared on everybody's radar screen with health reform, says Todd Yates, a partner with Raleigh-based Hill, Chesson, and Woody, which offers benefits consulting. A captive is basically like setting up your own insurance company that is made up of companies that comprise the pool. I think that you are going to see captives take hold in the 50 to 100 employee market significantly. Mr. Rick Kelly, managing partner with Raleigh's Progressive Benefit Solutions, extends that out to companies that employ as many as 200. Next up, millions on denial list will be able to get health policy. By Jason DeBrun, from Chapel Hill. It should come as a surprise to exactly no one that the health care delivery and payment system in the United States will continue to go through major changes, especially as a new regulations from the Affordable Care Act take effect in 2014. One of the more significant rules that kicks in on January 1st of that year is the requirement that no person can be denied coverage based on a pre-existing condition. In North Carolina alone, this could affect more than 2 million people, estimates Families USA, a liberal-leaning Washington, D.C. think tank that commissioned the Lewin Group, a healthcare consulting company headquartered in Falls Church, Virginia, to calculate the number of Americans with pre-existing medical conditions. In the 13 counties that make up the triangle alone, there are 370,300 residents with pre-existing conditions, or about 24% of the population. This means they face denial of coverage or at risk of having to accept reduced coverage. Some insurance providers, for example, will offer coverage to a woman who recently had shoulder surgery, but not cover any physical therapy related to that shoulder. The healthcare industry is already bracing for more customers coming through its doors. Dr. Brian Goldstein, Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the UNC Hospitals in Chapel Hill, says, At least in the first few years of health reform, there will be an increased demand for some health services. Some people will have new coverage to address injuries and illnesses, and others will have better coverage than before, he reasons. Thinking that through, however, he adds that it could result in more bad debt for hospitals or unpaid bills from newly insured patients who don't pay their out-of-pocket expenses such as copays or deductibles. Another effect of higher demand could mean an even greater shortage of physicians. In the past few years, the U.S. health care market has faced a growing need for primary care physicians, particularly in rural areas. Now, with the ACA being upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, the Association of American Medical Colleges, headquartered in Washington, D.C., estimates the shortage to increase to 130,600 by 2025, or 20% more without the Affordable Care Act. The report led Association President Dr. Daryl Kirch to again call on Congress to increase the number of federally funded residency training programs, what he and others have said is a real bottleneck, not medical school. The AAMC does not break out shortage projections by state, but it does have data that shows North Carolina already ranks slightly below the state median in physicians per 100,000 residents. The triangle is not likely to feel shortage pressures as acutely as other areas in the state because of the existence of two major medical universities to the west of Raleigh and a new College of Osteopathic Medicine opening at Campbell University south of Raleigh. Goldstein is well aware of the impending shortage, but says a bigger issue is how the system thinks about demand for services. For example, how many office visits per year should a patient with adult-onset diabetes have with her primary care physician? He answers rhetorically, our system has only just begun to get at all parties' interest aligned to start talking about these issues. With ACA's individual mandate and elimination of the pre-existing medical condition restrictions, many see the individual insurance market growing, particularly with an influx of young adults. When this population seeks insurance, it will be heavily weighed in the individual market. I think the market has grown and continues to grow, Layden says. The individual market is wide open. But shopping for health insurance is not something in which this population is not well-versed. They're not sick, and nobody's ever taught them, Layden says. Some high-deductible plans, which are recommended for young, healthy adults, can cost less than $100 per month. Not surprisingly, the number of people with pre-existing conditions increases with age, the Family USA report shows. In North Carolina, for example, only 7.2% of those 17 or younger have a pre-existing condition, while 49% of those in 55 to 64 age bracket have a condition that puts them at risk for being denied coverage. Pre-existing conditions do not discriminate based on income. The groups divided the data into five separate income groups, with the highest being those of 400% above the poverty line, or annual income of $92,200 for a family of four. All five groups combined were separated by fewer than 3 percentage points. This week's editor's notebook is from Sugata Mukherjee. What college system finances show us. No one is saying North Carolina is spending too much on education. In fact, as a nation, we may not be spending enough, but the findings of an in-depth report on page one of this issue of how the University of North Carolina system is balancing its books when compared to some select schools across the nation are startling. And obviously, that's not good news for North Carolinians looking to send their kids to one of these schools sprawled across 15 campuses. As reporters Lee Weisbecker and Jason DeBruin reviewed the revenue stream of colleges in the country, their conclusion became obvious. More and more, the burden of higher education in our state will be on the parents rather than on the government. So far, the UNC system has managed to garner enough support from state lawmakers over the years to keep the tuition costs low. In fact, as the headline to the story package states, it's a myth that the state is not supporting its university system. During the last academic year, UNC Chapel Hill received about $535 million in state appropriations and about $290 million in tuition and fees. Compare this to, say, the University of Michigan. Michigan's flagship university, which received $308 million in state appropriations and collected $1.25 billion in student tuition and fees. And not to mention, Michigan has a much bigger student base, 29,137 at Chapel Hill versus Michigan's 42,716, a scenario that should generate more support from state government. So why this massive disparity? As Georgetown University Vice President Matthew Lambert said, the Tar Heel State, through its state government, has been more faithful in supporting higher education than any other state university system over the past two centuries. So now we know that while UNC system officials have had some major funding cuts in the past couple of years, the level of state support is still among the best in the nation. Educators and university administrators will always throw caution to the wind when an income source is being paired. More often than not, they use education and students as the casualty. With the economy the way it is and the makeup of the state legislature, it's unlikely that lawmakers will come in next year and give back the money it cut to schools. But the schools need the revenue to recruit good professors, to expand course offerings, to buy new lab equipment, upgrade their technology, etc. Where will the money come from? The $414 million cut was an eye-opener for university administrators. Now continues the work of aligning resources to provide the best education to the student body as thousands of parents wonder if they'll be left holding the tab from here on. The Frank Hawkins Keenan Institute of Private Enterprise at UNC Chapel Hill will launch a $1.6 million center to promote business growth and job creation in eastern North Carolina. The Center for Jobs and Innovative Business Development will be funded by a five-year, $642,949 grant from the U.S. Economic Development Administration and a $1 million in matching funds from the Keenan Institute. The Eastern Plains region's counties are among the state's most economically distressed, due largely to declines in tobacco industry in recent decades. The new center will work through established economic development agencies and councils of government in the region to implement its programs and promote economic growth. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleradingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.